This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. UConn settles in a lawsuit over sexual assault on campus. An edit of one of our interviews makes the editorial pages. And no song represents the epic battle for the 33rd district in the State House like Chubby Checker's The Twist. Those are just a few of the stories we'll be talking about today on The Wheelhouse, our weekly look at the news. Coming up later, the Hartford Courant's Danny Haar stops by to update us on his walk across the state on Route 44. It's been a long slog. We'll find out what he's seen so far. You can join the conversation, as always, 860-275-7266, 860-275-7266. Comment on our website, WNPR.org. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter, at Where We Live. Joining us, as always, is Colin McEnroe, host of The Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR. Hello there, Colin.
Actually, I think King Crimson's 21st Century Schizoid Man fully describes almost all legislative races in Connecticut.
Maybe we should have a King Crimson show later. You'd probably do that on the Colin McEnroe Show. Thanks, by the way, for hosting for me last week, Colin.
I appreciate it. A lot of fun. We missed you.
Also joining us is Keith Faniff. He's the state budget reporter for the Connecticut Mirror. Hi there, Keith. How are you?
Very good. I don't have any music, though, any themes for my
We should get
stories.
You a theme. We really should get you a state budget theme.
Yeah. Just not something with, like, you know, money, money, money. No, that's been overplayed.
It's more like My Heart Will Survive.
We'll have somebody write something for you. Of course, one of the stories that we want to get to this week is a story that Colin wrote about in the Sunday Current, a column about the migrant children who are coming from devastated countries in Central America. They're making their way all the way to the U.S.-Mexico border, and many of them need to find places to stay temporarily while the United States tries to figure out what exactly to do with them. There's an offer made to the state to house some 2,000 of these kids at the Southbury Training School. Governor Daniel Malloy said no to that plan. We're going to read from a statement that Governor Malloy put out last night about this issue. Before we turn to Paul Bass from the New Haven Independent and talk a little bit about New Haven's role in all this, Colin, I'd like you to just sort of recap your thinking on some of this. I know that you tackled this on your Monday program. Governor Malloy has faced an awful lot of heat for this. It may very well be that he made a political calculation to say no to housing these migrant kids. It may very well be that he had something else in mind in terms of a facility for these kids. But at the end of the day, you and many others have written quite strongly about this issue.
Yeah, I actually don't think there's really any question that politics entered into this. And I mean, one reason that that's pretty clear is that you just mentioned that later you're going to read from his statement. I mean, there is no audio of Dan Malloy ever talking about this issue, to the best of my knowledge, because he doesn't want there to be any audio of him talking about this issue. And so far he has communicated with – I mean, Dan Malloy is not a difficult person from whom to extract a quote on an ordinary day with an ordinary topic. But he's communicated with the world almost exclusively through surrogates about this. I want to bracket that and just say there may be really almost nothing of any kind of long-term value that the state could have done. Now that I know a little bit more about the immigration law on this, and I mean this really may be a very, very horrible dead end. But I think what people are responding to is the absence of any kind of energy around this issue from him. And now, as Paul is going to explain in just a second, you really are starting to see a lot of energy from a lot of other people, from people at nonprofits and from mayors. There are a lot of people who are saying, "Wait, what? What can we do? You know, what are our resources? Let's acknowledge that maybe, you know, Southbury is falling down. But what can we do? This is too big a problem for us to sort of just shrug our shoulders and say, no, at a bureaucratic level, the thing you, the federal government, just suggested can't be done. So bye. Bye. Great talking to you. Now, the Malloy administration has adjusted its position a little bit. And that seems to be as a result also of just really, really bad press. And I'll just say one more thing.
Sure.
Which is that, you know, I mean, yeah, it's a political decision, but it's a very dicey political position. And one reason he doesn't want there to be a whole lot of video or audio of him is that he really needs the Latino vote in this election. So he can neither afford, apparently, to do anything that would call attention to his accommodation of these children, nor really in any really emphatic way be caught being completely callous about the situation. So he's in this kind of peculiar twilight zone, a political position that doesn't really exist.
And he needs the Latino vote, certainly, in this November election. He also needs the support of all the cities, including maybe especially New Haven. So I want to turn to Paul Bass, the editor of the New Haven Independent, who's been following this story there. Maybe you can pick up on what Collins had to say so far, Paul, and just tell us, what are people in the city of New Haven looking to do to address this migrant crisis?
Yeah, and it's interesting. I was interested in what Colin was saying about the politics, because what's happened since, I totally agree with Colin's analysis about the first step, is that sometimes politics drives better policy. Often, first-blush politics and polls lead politicians to do something awful or stupid. And Malloy's first reaction was just, forget it, we can't. He didn't just say Southbury doesn't work. He said nowhere in the state works. Sorry. Because of politics, as you noted, he's had to reconsider. New Haven is the epicenter of the state's immigrants' rights movement. It is, you can't, just like you have to be a Democrat in New Haven or else you get sent to purgatory, it's the official state religion. Immigrant rights is a real cornerstone issue in the city. Every elected official has to be for it. You know, state Senator Martin Looney and all the whole delegation, Ron Candelaria, have passed at the state level immigrant rights legislation that the governor has signed. And I actually believe that historically the governor, it's one of his few issues like the death penalty that he actually has a stand on, which I think he does believe in. But you're right, it's an election year, it's a tight election. He's worried about the anti-immigrant backlash. Although in Connecticut, I'm not sure he read it right. Because outside of Danbury, where you know Mark Mountain has always hot-dogged the issue to get up Fox News and drove all the Ecuador immigrants out, I think Connecticut is more welcoming of immigrants, and especially of immigrant rights at a tragedy like this. I'm noticing in the reaction in New Haven that people really care about these children. They are fleeing severe violence. They're running across the border for their lives. So now you have this humanitarian crisis. And then when New Haven, they started, activists started working on this from day one. You know, Kika Matos from New Haven actually runs the national organization that organizes around state capitals everywhere in the country on this issue. And there's a lot of grassroots support. We have a large immigrant community, but also more important to the politicians than the immigrants who are not registered voters are the activists and the general voters who supported the introduction in New Haven of a municipal ID card for undocumented workers, which now New York and other cities have done. We have a police policy now that says you can't ask immigrants about their country of origin. So from day one, this hit hard. And then the hard part for Malloy's allies in the state, the Democratic mayors and politicians in cities like New Haven, is that they don't want to hurt his reelection chances, but they don't want to hurt their own reelection chances. So immediately all the New Haven politicians embraced the cause of these children, I think out of sincerity too, but they didn't want to criticize the governor. So the line he threw them was, Southbury's no good. And actually, when you think about it further, everyone agrees you don't want to jail these kids, right? You don't want to put hundreds or thousands of kids in a place that you couldn't even put inmates before. And if people thought about it more, they even said warehousing in general might not be the idea. So what's happened in New Haven, in addition to the heat on the street, including a rally yesterday with 50 people said stood outside a former community college building, Gateway, that's empty. Said, hey, you can even put them there. In truth, by now, people don't even think you should put them there. That might not be even set up as a good place to just throw a lot of kids in. But quietly, behind the scenes, there's been a lot of work about smart places to put the kids. So in all the mayors of Boughton hasn't signed up yet. We'll see if he will or not. If he was still running for lieutenant governor, he might have to pretend to be humane and join it too. But in the other cities, Bridgeport, New Haven, Hartford, the mayors are talking about putting together a plan of smaller facilities and maybe individual family placements that would be on a much larger scale than the several hundred that Malloy says his Department of Children and Families have located. Well, secondly, yeah. Community groups, religious groups, there's a group called IRIS, Immigrant Refugee Immigration Services, in New Haven, have already said, we're going to also find places for these people to live, place them with families in New Haven and in other cities, as well as maybe some smaller facilities.
Let's actually hear from the mayor of New Haven, Tony Harp. She was speaking to WNPR's Lucy Nalpathanchil yesterday.
The Armory, which is now empty, there is also the old Gateway facility that we could possibly look at. We've also been in discussions with some churches that have extra space. And the thought is that there may actually be families that have worked with the probate court over time that may want to take in children.
And before I go to the governor's statement that he put out yesterday, Colin, addressing some of these things, maybe you can talk about what Paul just said, this analysis that, yes, indeed, city mayors are in kind of a bind here. They've got their constituents clearly wanting one thing. They don't want to do anything to hurt Governor Malloy's reelection chances. Tony Harp, probably, Colin, walking a little bit of a fine line here.
Yeah, no, but I thought Paul's analysis was really good, too, that what really happened here, they didn't have the Malloy people, their campaign, they didn't have time to focus group this thing, and there aren't any existing polls about, you know, taking thousands of migrant children into your system. So they just, you know, somebody made a guess, you know, and sometimes in the heat of battle, somebody's guess, you know, it really is kind of a snap judgment, which nobody really talks about very much. So I'm guessing somebody in the campaign said, "No, we can't do that. They'll beat the stuffing out of us if we get hung up on this issue," and that was that. And now a much more finely grained and nuanced intelligence is kind of spreading across this issue in just the way that Paul described, and it's really causing Malloy to realize that maybe that wasn't so great. But he's still in a kind of a terrible position because he sort of said this first thing and now he can be a little bit more enlightened. But, once again, we haven't really seen him kind of step out in front of some microphones and say all this stuff.
Keith Vanoff? Just very quickly, Paul, I just want to get a word in from Keith.
For a second, I'm going to back up what Colin said, go a little all the president's men on you. Pardon my blowing our horn. We broke this story at the Mirror, and I had put in an FOI request to the administration for emails between the federal government and the governor's policy agency. They waited about 2 weeks to respond. I put in my request at about 2 p.m. The federal government had asked for an answer about 2 weeks earlier. Around 4:20, just before they released the emails to me, they responded to the federal government, which is, in other words, they put this off as long as they could till it was clear that it was going to come out. What Colin said about Southbury, it's true that wasn't, you know, the only alternative. I had sources that said they looked at the CSU system. They offered every objection. Well, we have to go through a special process to use surplus land. You could call a special session and get property opened up immediately if you were convinced it was there. And they didn't respond that first day. They just released their emails. They didn't respond when a group in New Haven planned a rally. They didn't respond when the state's Latino Affairs Commission called for alternatives. Finally, when the legislature's Black and Puerto Rican caucus spoke up, and it was clear, in other words, it wouldn't go away, an administration that has never hesitated to respond grudgingly said something. And I think it's exactly what Colin said. They tried. They didn't have time to focus group it, and the issue was getting out.
I'm just going to read the statement quickly from Dan Malloy's office that came out last night and then get a last word from Paul Bass here. He writes, "I continue to work closely with the federal government on this important issue. Today I participated in a conference call with the White House and the Secretaries of Homeland Security and Health and Human Services. It appears that substantial progress has been made to diminish the need for housing children for extended periods in large-scale institutional settings. For example, the facility at Nogales now houses 22 children, down from more than 1,000. Much of this work has been accomplished by pursuing the appropriate step of placing children as quickly as possible with relatives, a position that we have advocated for the past week." He goes on to say the federal government has placed more than 320 children with relatives in Connecticut. Paul Bass, I'll give you the last word on this. You've heard some of the analysis and also Keith Vanoff talking about how slow the Malloy administration was to respond.
I think the outcome, John, my prediction, is that the Democratic mayors bail out Malloy. They give him good policy that then he can be embraced with political cover in the stronghold throughout the city. It'll be the right solution, I think. And in the end, we all have to thank the Connecticut Mirror for dogged reporting. It shows the power of keeping accountable, the press keeping officials accountable.
Nick, one of our tweeters, is in alignment with this. He writes, "Malloy is leaning on local leadership to shift focus away from his mistake. We deserve better state leadership." That's from Nick. I want to thank Paul Bass, as always. He's the editor of the New Haven Independent. Good to talk to you, Paul.
Same here, John. Thanks a lot.
If you want to join us, you can call us at 860-275-7266. It's the Wheelhouse, our weekly news roundtable. We're going to quickly turn to another big story. Last week, the University of Connecticut settled a lawsuit filed by five women for $1.3 million. The women claimed the school responded to their sexual assault complaints with indifference. At a press conference, several of the women joined attorney Gloria Allred and shared their responses to the settlement. Here is recent UConn graduate Carolyn Luby.
"This lawsuit has catalyzed change on UConn's campus so that hopefully future generations of students do not have to experience sexual violence. And if they do, there will be systems in place to ensure they get the help and justice they deserve.
Keith Fan, if you were there and covered this, what can we take away from the settlement?
I think the University of Connecticut needed to put this issue to rest, and I think more than anything you've seen, they're going to try to move forward and not present this defensive position that they took when this all began. I think that was probably the biggest PR nightmare for them, that they came out and didn't seem to show a lot of compassion for the people who came forward. And I think that did a lot of damage to their image.
Colin, it seems in some ways, just what Keith said, these first two stories in some ways, I guess, combined. There's an initial response which seems maybe heartless and cruel. And then, as Paul Bass suggested in the first story we talked about, out of that perhaps comes some enlightenment and a little bit of thoughtfulness. You know, we often hit people for what they say first and how they first respond. Is this a good outcome now for UConn, actually settling this lawsuit with this woman? And hearing Carolyn Luby say that this actually has catalyzed something on campus, maybe this all works out for the best?
I think it does. And I think also, I mean, look, nobody likes to spend $1.3 million on anything, particularly something that you don't really get any real tangible result out of. Nobody likes to spend that kind of money kind of making up for a past fault. So, I mean, that is a way of focusing the mind a little bit right there. I will say this. You know, whenever things like this happen, and I understand why they happen and how they happen exactly for the reason that Keith said, there's always this sort of strange little dissonance about the fact that, you know, nobody's ever been charged in any of these rapes. I mean, there, you know, if in fact there's like $1.3 million worth of sexual violence damage done to people at the University of Connecticut, no one has ever faced a charge on any of this. So, I mean, I think probably it's the way of the world. We're going to lock this whole thing in a closet and move forward. And that's probably what we should do. But I have to think among the activists, that's still a little bit of an odd little question.
And do you think in the end, Keith Fan, this does actually lead to some systemic change? I mean, the state legislature took a look at this. There are a number of public hearings about laws enforcing sexual assault on campus, not just at state schools, but also at private universities. I mean, has this meant some change on this very important issue in the state?
It really is going to depend on how well the university stays keeps up with providing support services, because Colin a second ago referenced charges. But the truth is, with so many sexual assaults, because of the shame factor, which is not guilt, it's a totally different emotion. So many times nothing ever does come forward, but that doesn't mean the victims still don't need assistance. And I think it will come down to if the university maintains those services and continues to provide some type of support for the victims, that'll be the real test.
Coming up on the program, we'll check in with the Hartford Courant's Dan Haar about his walk down Route 44. Yeah, he's walking all the way across the state. He'll actually be in Hartford today, so he's going to stop by. He'll probably be out of breath. I'll also check in on the governor's race in the Republican primary, which is less than 3 weeks away, believe it or not. You can join us as always, 860-275-7266. We're joined by Keith Faniff of the Connecticut Mirror, Colin McEnroe of WNPR here on The Wheelhouse on Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. It's Wednesday, so that means The Wheelhouse, our weekly news roundtable. We're tackling the week's news with Keith Faniff. He's the budget reporter for the Connecticut Mirror, and also Colin McEnroe, the host of the Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR. What do you have for us this afternoon at 1 o'clock, Colin?
Well, Betsy E. Kaplan, our fine producer, is producing a show about middle names and middle initials, especially middle initials. What's your middle initial?
It's K.
See, we've known you all this time, and we don't know that.
Do you know what it stands for?
No, what does it stand for?
Kenneth.
Kenneth. So one of the theories is these days that middle initials, for some reason or other, are falling out of fashion and out of favor. It seems odd in an era of disambiguation that would be the case. You'd almost want more information because you know more names. You need to tell more people apart. But anyway, we'll be exploring the world of onomastics, which is the name for the study of names.
What is your middle initial, Colin?
It is W.
It's W. I'll have to figure out what it's for. Keith, how about you?
M.
It's M. Okay. So if you want to give us a call and guess their middle names, 860-275.
No, that'll be this afternoon.
Oh, that'll be this afternoon. Okay. Don't call now.
Heavy phones of people guessing middle
names. Heavy phones. That's exactly what will happen. Before we move on to the race for governor, I just want to quickly note something that happened early Monday morning. State Senator Andrew Maynard took a big fall at his home in Stonington and was rushed to the hospital. Details about what happened and his condition have sort of trickled out. But his sister released a statement yesterday saying his injuries now are non-life-threatening. Our friend Ben Duvall, who is a longtime friend of Andy Maynard, a longtime political observer who's been on this program many times, just told me he can report that Andy had a good night last night and continues to improve. Keith, I think one of the reasons I wanted to bring this up is, first of all, to just wish Andy Maynard and his family and friends the very best and a very speedy recovery. But I think it's this sort of story, it often puts in some context some of the political battles that we have, especially in an election year. We think a lot about politics in a way that has people pitted against one another. And this is someone who I think is well-liked on both sides of the aisle.
Absolutely. I think it was just sort of a shock to everybody at the Capitol. I think that the way you put it is probably the best way to do it. It just sort of – everybody kind of for a moment has a reality check.
Colin?
You put it well. He is well-liked, I think, on both sides of the aisle. I don't know anybody who doesn't like Andy Maynard, and he has a lot of friends. I've been hearing from the novelist Lou Anne Rice just came back from a book tour. I got an email from her last night saying, you know, I'm sick about Andy Maynard. How is he? I think the other thing that you're sort of saying is we do think about these people in pretty sterile ways a lot of the time. I mean, most of the time they're parts of vote totals or we're pouncing on some bad position that they just took or a speech that was either eloquent or terrible from the floor. But these are human beings and they live their lives. And occasionally, you know, whether it's Art Ward, the mayor of Bristol, almost died from choking on something to Andy falling off a balcony. I mean, they live their lives and sometimes really horrible things happen to them.
Well, I wish Andy Maynard the very best in a speedy recovery, and we'll certainly give you updates as we have them on his condition. Now, making that left-hand turn, we're going to head to the Republican primary for governor just under 3 weeks away. A Senate minority leader and underdog candidate, John McKinney, opened his campaign headquarters last night. Keith, your colleague Mark Pasnioka said McKinney has had perhaps the best week of his year-long campaign after his performance in a Fox Connecticut Hartford Current debate last week. McKinney handled questions on everything from immigration to Common Core to the Newtown shooting. Let's listen.
I was with them at the firehouse that day. I shared the pain with those families when they were told their kids weren't coming back. I'm proud that I'm the only voice they have in the state Senate, and I've been their voice.
So, Keith, that performance and some of the other things that have happened around the ads, was it a good week for John McKinney in his campaign?
It's been an excellent week for him. The question is it too little too late? Because he's in primary battle with an opponent, Tom Foley, who's in a classic four-corner delay and does not seem right now to have many opinions.
He doesn't seem to have many opinions. He's trying not to give the other candidates any sort of ammunition.
No, I mean, Tom is literally just falling back on cliches and looking like he's trying to run out the clock. Senator McKinney does not have a lot of time. He has got to find issues with traction, sort of go for it. And I think that's what you're seeing right now.
I think, you know, if the McKinney campaign is subsequently analyzed by anybody, it really will be seen as kind of an error in not getting into campaign mode a lot earlier. I mean, and even sort of in between the time of the end of the legislative session and this best week ever, I mean, his basic approach was kind of a little bit more on the order of Boo Radley and Emily Dickinson. I mean, you could barely find this guy, you know, and so suddenly he's out and he's kind of an interesting campaigner, as Paz is suggesting. Once he finally got going, it's kind of interesting to watch him and see what he has to do. Now, one kind of interesting area to ponder is ordinarily, if you're John McKinney and you're planning to do what he's planning to do, the legislative session that precedes that moment is a time of disgusting posturing, you know, that every single issue that presents itself, every miscue by the governor, you move in, you take the spotlight, you grab the microphones, and you make it your issue. And he didn't do that, and perhaps that's to his credit. But on the other hand, it didn't help him at all. I mean, as a result, every Q poll that's ever come out indicates that people know a lot more about the starting lineup for Argentina in the World Cup than they do about John McKinney, which is not a good thing.
You know, one of the things that we haven't talked about on this show yet was what happened last week after McKinney released his first television spot. We recognized that the audio he used of Tom Foley was from our program. It was audio that the McKinney campaign had sort of edited in an interesting way. Let's listen to what Tom Foley originally said on Where We Live and then how the McKinney campaign used it.
I'm not saying I'm going to cut spending. I'm saying I'm going to hold spending flat. I'm not going to cut spending. I'm not going to cut spending.
So this caused a little bit of a firestorm. The McKinney campaign acknowledged the words were edited, but the meaning didn't change. Several people wrote about this. It actually ended up just yesterday in a Hartford Current editorial talking about how candidates shouldn't use audio bites in this way. Much ado over nothing, Keith?
I think the Current editorial raised a fair point. There is the integrity of the quote, and that includes the context, and that's one thing. On the other hand, I do think Tom Foley is playing this messaging so fine in an effort not to offend anybody, anybody's cousin, anybody's cousin's prom date, that he's finding himself painted into a corner. He has basically said his very broad general strategy for closing the deficit that we're projecting in the budget after the election is he's going to try to live within the same bottom line. I don't believe, though, he has ever said, if I find some place to cut spending and it leaves me below the bottom line, well, I'm going to have to find some place to spend because I've got to, you know, I promised I'd stay right at that amount. And I think he was trying to make a point in the debate that, no, I'm not going to spend money recklessly. But on the other hand, I am not going to do a slash and burn. And he's too busy trying, like I said, to make sure he doesn't offend anybody. And, you know, he probably produced a very careless statement that John McKinney or sentence fragment that John McKinney pounced on.
And we're actually going to talk about the budget implications of all this and what you're finding out from the candidates. But I just like your take on this, Colin. I mean, this is the sort of story that obviously gets us up in arms. We don't like our audio being used for campaign ads. We have a policy against that, and it's happened periodically, and we've got to chase people down who do it, especially when you take it and edit it and don't say where it's from. You know, the Hartford Current actually thought it was a big enough deal to write an editorial about it. Is it?
Well, first of all, because you can't say it, I just do want to say that the person who figured all this out is John Kenneth Dankosky, and that Tucker and I came
along
in
with Tucker Ives.
Yeah,
yes.
Well, no, but Tucker and I came in that morning, and you said, if you looked at that ad, you said, there's something wrong. The audio doesn't really match up with the video, and I think it's actually our audio. You knew that right away. I don't know how you knew that, but and then Tucker did the detective work after that. And
because every word that Tom Foley says to me while sitting in that chair that you're in today, Colin, is imprinted on my mind forever.
I would be so in a coma during that time. But anyway, so look, campaign ads are not documentaries, right? I mean, we know that liberties will be taken. We know that reality will be twisted around. We know that, you know, average people on the street are often hired actors and stuff like that. They're not documentaries. But I would say they crossed a line here. They crossed two lines, really. I think, first of all, matching up the audio with the video. In other words, what you see there, and it's kind of Blair Witchy looking, too. There's sort of this video of Foley kind of turning and, you know, looking over his shoulder in kind of a menacing way while he's saying, I'm not going to cut spending. And so, first of all, you're matching up video with audio when they don't really go together. And then you're actually editing the audio to, you know, substantially modify its meaning or at least really pull it way out of context. I think a line is crossed there. Now, I do want to say I think John McKinney is a victim of his advertising agency. Candidates do not sit there and go, wait a minute, his mouth is moving kind of funny. And I mean, they just don't have time. They don't worry about it. I mean, he's going to have to own it because that's just the way it works. But really, the people who should be drawn and quartered over this are the advertising agency that did it. They really did cross a line. There are so few rules in political advertising, but they managed to find one and break it.
Well, but just very quickly, one of the things that John McKinney has been running on, you said that he didn't use this last legislative session to posture. That's to his credit. Maybe it wasn't necessarily good for him. He came on our show and in several other places and said, I'm not going to run a negative campaign. And then instead of his first ad being an ad introducing himself, which is something that clearly needs to happen because most people in the state don't know who he is, it's an attack. It's essentially an ad that's exactly the ad that he said he wasn't going to run.
Yeah, and, you know, I mean, political advertising, yeah. It was an attack ad on both Malloy and Foley, which is a shotgun blast of birdshot that just I don't know how that can possibly work for him. I would just say political ads bring out the worst in everybody. And, you know, and every time you look at them, I mean, I have to say, somebody pointed this out to me, but he's absolutely right. I'm really troubled by Malloy's initial ad where he talked about when evil stalked the halls of Sandy Hook. You know, I mean, I thought it was a kid with an untreated mental illness whose parents didn't secure their guns. I wasn't aware that we were going to subscribe to this kind of almost supernatural way of talking about it. Evil, you know? But I just think, you know, once again, I don't think Malloy had a lot of control over that. The ad guys, they take this over. Your campaign manager, whoever your general contractor campaign manager is supposed to make sure that you don't cross certain lines. But those lines will be approached and sometimes breached.
Well, as we're talking about the supernatural here, Keith, let's talk about the state budget. Yesterday, unofficial budget numbers released. The Malloy administration says the state ended the fiscal year with a $121 million surplus. John McKinney, of course, responded to this, saying this is a paper surplus. You've been doing reporting on all of these candidates, including on John McKinney. How do you think that what they're saying is kind of in alignment with the realities that you know from covering the budget day to day?
Well, I think what we're actually seeing, believe it or not, is the impact of the unaffiliated candidates, call them what you want, the third party, the independents. Flashback maybe 4 months ago when word came out that we were looking at as much as $1.4 billion deficit, and that, you know, to give people some perspective, that's 7%. We've never had enough economic growth to cover that in 1 year. We've never been able to find that much in tax cuts in 1 year. In other words, we've never closed a shortfall like that without tax hikes. That's tax hike territory. Okay? When that first came out, you know, we had Governor Malloy, what, me worry? There's not even a deficit. What are you talking about? We had Republicans saying, I will take care of that, and I'm going to roll back all these tax increases that we had from the last term, and nobody was dealing with the reality. Now we have two petitioning candidates, Joe Visconti on the far right, John Pelto on the far left. Visconti's walking around at his interviews carrying budget books, and no, I did not put him up to that. He's doing that on his own. a very conservative individual saying you can't really responsibly rule out tax hikes, talking about trying to find savings in Medicaid fraud. You've got John Pelto, who's already rolled out a pretty detailed plan for a very significant progressive income tax hike, you know, aiming at the very wealthy, sales tax reform, cuts back on corporate assistance. And I think you're seeing them begin to have an effect on the major party candidates. John McKinney has stopped saying I can roll back $1.5 billion in tax increases and is actually talking about smaller cuts. Tom Foley's not saying much, but what he did say in his interview with us, besides trying to flat fund the budget, is maybe we can have some modest sales tax cuts over the next 2 years. The real test, the litmus test, will be when we have our interview with Governor Malloy, which is still upcoming. He's denied the entire existence of the deficit.
Well,
I wanted to get Colin stoked up. It was either that or use your middle initial, and I knew this would get him going.
Well, and we've got more of these coming up in Keith's series. We're still going to hear from Tom Foley. We're going to hear from Dan Malloy on the success of Mondays in the Connecticut Mirror. You can read this series. We've discussed this a lot, and we have Keith on to talk about the state budget. Colin, let's just talk about the budget in the context of state politics. When it comes to taxes, I think people kind of can get that and say, I either want more taxes or less taxes. I want my money used for this or I want my money used for that. Outside of that, the idea of a budget surplus or a deficit, I feel sometimes like it just glazes over on people. And when they're in the voting booth, they're not really thinking about the things the way that, let's say, Keith is thinking about them.
Yes. Well, yeah, and because nobody besides Keith is thinking about them that way.
Perhaps,
by the way,
that's true.
Kids, if somebody approaches you in a dark car with a budget book, that's Keith. Don't take it, all right? He tried to do it with Joe Visconti. Don't do it, all right? Don't take the budget book.
That's not Keith Michael Faniff. That's the other Keith Faniff. I don't know that guy.
So, I mean, look, I think the one thing that you won't hear, and, you know, even if I were advising one of these candidates, I would advise them this way. You won't hear the kind of realistic talking that Keith just did. You won't hear anybody saying, look, there's no way to fix this without raising taxes. No one's going to do that. And as I say, if I were advising them, even though I believe in honesty, I would advise them not to do that. It is an absolutely guaranteed way to lose an election. Now, I think Keith's point is really interesting about the outside candidates, and maybe an analogy could be made between here and the presidential election in 1992, where Perot talked and talked and talked and talked about the deficit, and nobody really I don't think during the campaign, I could be wrong about this, but I don't think during the campaign he really changed anybody that much. But when Clinton got in office and realized he had to do something, you know, he suddenly became a deficit hawk. Bill Curry probably has some really good inside explanation for how that happened. But, you know, you have to give Perot a certain amount of credit for that.
Well, he didn't change any money. He got a certain percentage of the vote, which was important to that election.
He got 19%. So,
that's right.
Can I ask you both something, though? Because I think Perot did change two minds, and I'm wondering if Pelto and Visconti are doing the same thing. Perot, in my opinion, changed what Clinton and Bush could discuss on the campaign trail. Not entirely, but he pushed the needle. I'm wondering what you guys think if Pelto and Visconti are finding they're getting more press, more airtime as truth tellers, and if they get invited to debates, will that affect what the Republican candidate and what Governor Moy can say? Because it's hard to promise the world when somebody next to you is saying that's the exact opposite of the reality. We have to brace for more pain. So I'm wondering if you guys think they can change what the candidate is.
You go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say, I think the key issue is, are these folks going to get into debates? I think it's fair to say that Jonathan Pelto is on his way to getting on the ballot, which means he very well might be in several of these debates. I don't think we're sure about Joe Visconti, and I think that does kind of tell the tale, Colin.
Yeah, I mean, at the moment, they're not having any impact because nobody knows what they're saying. You know, it's late July. I mean, I get paid to think about this stuff. I don't know what Joe Visconti is saying about it right now. And it really does depend exactly on how much press coverage do they get, you know, particularly as we roll into the fall and people actually sort of start paying some attention to the election, and whether they get up on the stage in the debates. I mean, I think those are really important things. And if that happens, yeah, I mean, that's sort of been the prediction all along, right? If Pelto and presumably Visconti get into the debates, they do start to tighten the lasso a little bit about what you can talk about and what you're going to get called on if you try to talk about it.
And, of course, the debates are important, the press coverage important, because those guys won't have any money to run any ads, the type that we've been talking about. This is the Wheelhouse, our weekly news roundtable. We're taking a look at some of the news of the week. Here's an unusual little item. It's not unusual to see big-name guests come stump and fundraise for political candidates, but we like this one. Chubby Checker is coming to Middletown tonight. Yes, joining us by phone is Cassandra Day, managing editor of the Middletown Press. And I know that you're a big Chubby Checker fan, Cassandra. Why exactly is the star of The Twist coming to stump in Middletown?
I can't say that I'm a fan. I actually had to do a lot of Googling and YouTubing to figure out exactly. I'm not that old, but when I was growing up, it was Sean Cassidy that I was into.
Oh, okay.
So I guess I'm dating myself there, but he's coming to for a meet and greet for a Republican candidate, Linda Sinkowitz. She's on the Board of Education. She's actually hoping to unseat Joe Serra, who's running for his 14th term in the 33rd Assembly District.
So why exactly is he coming there? Just a real close personal friendship with Linda?
Yeah, and when we got sent out that press release, I assume it was sent to a whole bunch of people. And when I saw it, it almost sounded like that it was anachronistic. Why would he be coming for something political? When I looked up everything that I could find about him online, he wasn't into politics at all. So I thought maybe he was coming for motorcycle mania or, you know, the cruise night on Maine here. He's coming to stump for her here and at the Italian Society in Middletown, which actually is kind of known as the Democratic unofficial headquarters, and where Joe Serra is probably every night after work.
I wonder, is Joe Serra in any danger of losing his seat in the 33rd District? I mean, we see every once in a while some of these seats that have been long held by either a Democrat or a Republican and tend to be safe seats. They'll come up for a close challenge. Does this tend to be one this time?
I don't want to predict anything, but I would say that if he's someone that I've been covering Middletown for probably 18 years, I've never seen him do a fundraiser. He hasn't needed to bring anyone to town, let alone some of his biggest Chubby Checkers.
He does have Iggy Azalea coming in now. So.
Colin, I don't want to doom his, you know, but
Well,
I don't think so.
I'd love to get your take on this, Comey. We see this every once in a while, but this is a particularly fun one for some reason, because I think just as we heard from Cassandra, I had no idea that Chubby Checker had any sort of political leanings whatsoever, or frankly, that Chubby Checker was even still with us.
Well, the story is kind of charming. And I mean, it seems like something that would happen to Kramer on Seinfeld or something that, you know, I mean, she ran into Alan King, the comedian, I think in a restaurant or something, and then he gave her tickets or put her on the guest list for his gig at the Oakdale, and then suddenly she's backstage, she meets a sound guy, she meets pretty soon she's riding around in limos with musicians, and somehow or other this led to not just a friendship with Chubby Checker, but he put money into one or more of her businesses over time. It is. It's something that Cosmo Kramer would do on a typical afternoon. All those things would happen to him. So whoever she is, and I've never heard of her before in my life, she must be a very affable person, because all these celebrities took to her like ducks to water.
Exactly. I know, Keith, you've covered a lot of campaigns. Have you seen anything like this one before?
No, I really haven't. I nor can I come up with a Seinfeld episode on the spot like Colin has. But no, I've never seen anything that this is almost just like one of those brushes with greatness that, you know, led to something.
Well, Cassandra, before I let you go here, I know you watch a lot of YouTube videos. Are you confident that now you know how to do the twist?
Yes, exactly. I do have to add one other thing that was kind of a strange story that she added, and I didn't put that in the story. And as you know, sometimes the best stuff doesn't necessarily make it into the story. She told me that she, when she found out that she secured him coming to town, she sent an email to the mayor and asking if he could, you know, issue a proclamation on July 23rd to name it Chubby Checker Day. And that email, she never received a response, so she followed up again. No response. And she finally called in and spoke with one of the secretaries there and said, you know, she's new to politics, so maybe it was kind of a naive request. Do you think we could get Chubby Checker, you know, the Mayor Drew, to issue a proclamation? And the woman, she said, stammered very much, and then said, I'm sorry, he's out of town that day. And then she said, well, what about the deputy mayor? Surely he must be able to do something like that. Again, stammering, no, I'm sorry, he's out of town. Well, who's number three in charge? Quiet. He's out of town, too. I'm sorry.
Everybody's out of town. He apparently, Chubby Checker will be allowed to use Senator Blumenthal's parking space at City Hall, though.
Oh, my goodness.
So it turns out that politics in Middletown is really a blood sport between the Republicans and the Democrats.
It's really something else. Well, Cassandra Day, thank you so much. Enjoy twisting the night away tonight, all right?
Yeah, exactly.
She's managing editor of the Middletown Press. As we head to break, our brush with greatness is Danny Haar from the Hartford Courant will join us to share some of his tales from Route 44. He's been walking the stretch of road reporting for the Courant on some of the stories he's come across. You can join us, as always, 860-275-7266. This is Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Coming up tomorrow, the recent Fuse scandal has raised some questions about charter schools. We'll take a broader look at charter schools around the country and how they're doing. How effective are they, and how much oversight do they have? We'd love to hear your thoughts. That's on tomorrow's Where We Live. Today, it's The Wheelhouse, our weekly news roundtable. As always, Colin McEnroe joins us. He's the host of The Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR. Keith Vanoff, who covers the state budget for the Connecticut Mirror, has been joining us as well. And walking into our studio now is Dan Haar. He's a columnist for the Hartford Courant. He's been walking across and reporting from Connecticut's Route 44. Danny, good to see you in one piece here.
Great to be here. Winsted was wonderful.
Oh, I can't wait to talk about my hometown of Winsted. You got a current 250-year hat. Are you actually wearing a backpack?
I'm wearing a backpack in the studio. I'm in Hartford. Actually, I made it as far as Woodland Street, which, for those of you who don't know, that's the cross street that we are on right now.
Excellent.
And I'm going to walk by St. Francis Hospital, because that is the old factory mill of the modern era, where many, many people in the neighborhood work.
You're not stopping by St. Francis because you've pulled something along the way? No, you're feeling okay? You're in good shape?
No, I feel good. I had a little slight ankle tweak when I started the trip from a sports thing, and it didn't get better or worse. So you sort of keep going in these things.
Well we're going to backtrack to your trip through my neck of the woods in just a moment. But one of the things that, while you're walking through Hartford, you've been talking to people about is this baseball stadium deal. We've been covering it a lot. It started with, we're going to borrow $60 million to bring a team from New Britain to Hartford. And now it's morphed into, we're not going to borrow any money. We're going to seek private development. We've got to do it fairly quickly. What are you hearing from people, Danny?
Well, I was along Albany Avenue last night. I will cross the stadium site today, which is, of course, right on Route 44 on Main Street, where Trumbull comes together there. The people, there's a surprising large amount of interest. I thought there would be disinterest because baseball is not a favored sport necessarily in the city, although there's something of a resurgence, which you've talked about. People want to see it. People want to see it. The issue is money. People want to see activity. And this is, in some ways, this is sort of the opposite of not in my backyard. I talked to some people last night in Upper Albany neighborhood over by Scott's Jamaican Bakery, which is actually where I was during the day. And they said, well, we'd really like to see it in Keeney Park. So it's a situation where it's like only in my backyard. And I said, well, what about 2 miles down the road in downtown Hartford? They said, well, you know, I may get down there, but Keeney Park would be great. We used to have horses and we used to have all a zoo in Keeney Park, all these things that have closed over the years. And they'd like to see that amenity there.
This is interesting. Actually, people wanting it in their backyard, Colin.
Yeah, I mean, sort of a lot of it depends on what is in your backyard at any given moment. And so Keeney Park is a city asset, which the city has badly bungled. I mean, we've covered this. I mean, they paid a huge landscaping fee for no landscaping whatsoever. The golf course is unusable. So, I mean, Keeney Park is a former city treasure that for a whole bunch of different reasons has fallen into a state of disuse and is occasionally a somewhat alarming place to be. So, yeah, it would be great, I think, to bring baseball to Keeney Park. I will say that, I mean, I think Danny's apprehension of the issue from the street is probably conforms pretty well to our journalistic understanding of it. We did have a very interesting moment over the weekend where Danny's colleague, Jeff Jacobs, a supporter of the idea of baseball in Hartford, as I would also like to say, as am I, said that he had figured out what the problem was, and it was that Pedro Segarra is, in his words, a nitwit. Now, this can have been a very happy day for Mayor Segarra. But, I mean, it really does sort of point to what's happened here with the baseball stadium, which is that it's a good idea that was rolled out in the wrong way without adequate public oversight and with way too much money committed. Everybody understood that, apparently, except Pedro Segarra, Sean Wooden, and Mr. Deller.
It's actually interesting. This is the third different story we've talked about where maybe just the rollout wasn't exactly what we were looking for. But quickly, Dan.
Mayor Segarra needs to understand and should be frank about the fact that there's no such thing as private investment in the stadium. There's private investment in the entire large development area that surrounds the stadium. You can give a developer parcels free of charge and say, here, if you build on this, you can have this, we'll subsidize you, and you can have the stadium to build as well. But there is no cash flow from the stadium, and therefore there's no such thing as private investment in the stadium, and we need to be clear about that.
So we just have a couple minutes with you, Dan, and you've walked off this trail. You've been walking the whole entirety of Route 44, and you've gotten all the way to Hartford so far. What have you seen on the way so far? You start out in Salisbury.
It's unbelievable. Well, Salisbury is actually the hearth of the armaments industry in Connecticut. It's the old forge there, the Salisbury Forge, where 880 cannon, as they say, not cannons, were made during the Revolutionary War. Unfortunately, Salisbury doesn't own one of them. They have one that they're not sure is from there.
and the anchor for the U.S. Constitution, too, right? USS Constitution.
Absolutely true. Yes, the anchor as well as all the guns on old Ironsides and everything else. And that really is the genesis of the armaments industry in Connecticut. We go and see in Winstead, the Barrett family, father and two sons, still holding forth in a mill where their family has been for 100 years overlooking the river. They were saved from the flood because the building next to them collapsed and diverted water. It's just an unbelievable collection of stories in this state.
I was going to say, you walk through these country towns, you know, Salisbury and Winstead, places that have changed over time. The places that have really changed in the last couple miles, your friend Tom Condon from the Current and I took a drive down a lot of my commute down Route 44. What did you think about the sort of sprawl bourbon part of Connecticut, the part that starts in around Canton and goes all the way into the city?
Well, I actually isolated the exact location in Canton where it begins. The sidewalk actually starts right on East Hill Road, right there. And if you look to your left, it's trees heading toward Route 202. And if you look to your right, it's all development. So we have an actual – people think it's gradual, and to some extent it is because Canton has old houses. But boom, there it is. And it's an effort – sprawl is a bad word. They don't like to use that word, sprawl. They like to use the word – you know, commercial development and so forth. And they like to say that they don't control it, but they guide it.
So what happens in the rest of the trip? You're going to walk through Hartford. You're going to talk more about the baseball stadium. You're headed all the way out to Pomfret, Putnam. Where does it end?
Putnam. Yes, Putnam is a great town reviving itself with around the mills and the arts district. And we end in Putnam. We're going to take a few days break right now because I'm going to catch up. I am still posting stories from Canton, New Hartford, a little bit Winsted, and yet I'm here in Hartford tweeting from Hartford. We need to catch up. There's too much to write. The state is too diverse.
Well, it's too diverse. It's a small state, but it's still a long to walk across. Dan Haar, you can read his stuff in the Hartford Current, his entire walk across Connecticut's Route 44. Thanks so much for stopping by, Dan. Continued success on your trip.
Thank you. That's current.com. Explore 44.
Explore 44. Keith Faniff, the state budget reporter for the Connecticut Mirror, who's going to be walking across the state with a budget book under his arm. Thank you so much, Keith, for joining us.
Putnam native Keith Faniff says thank you.
I didn't know you were from Putnam. That's good to hear. Colin McEnroe, host of the Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR. Thank you so much, Colin.
Thanks for showering, Danny.
Our program is produced by Lydia Brown and Tucker Ives. The executive producer is Katie Tolarski. I'm John Dankosky. Thanks for joining us in the wheelhouse here on Where We Live.